It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harrison for Celeste Headlee. On yesterday's program, we talked about how recipes can remind us of friends and loved ones. My next guest traces his ancestry, both black and white, through food. Michael Twitty is a culinary historian, and his new memoir, The Cooking Gene, he asks a pretty provocative question. Who owns Southern food? Michael speaks Thursday night at the Atlanta History Center, and he joins me now. Michael, good to talk to you. Thanks for being on the program.
Well, good morning. How y'all doing?
We're good. You know, that's a really good and provocative question. Who owns Southern food? What do you say to people who will hear that and want to know, first of all, is that really a question? Is that something to be debated?
Well, we all know who owned black people in 1860, don't we?
Okay.
So ownership is, you know, in a capitalist society, ownership and fences are very important. We're learning that the hard way, aren't we? So I would say that my answer is very nice and philosophical, and it goes like this. You know, who owns Southern food? Whoever is going to take responsibility for owning its past, maintaining its present, and securing its future in a positive and forward-leaning way. So it's not, for me, it's not about whether your phenotype is European or African or in between or native or anything else. It has to do with your values and how you look at the history of the food. And understand that Southern food is a billion, multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
But it came at a tremendous human cost. And if we don't acknowledge that and acknowledge the other surrounding issues, economics, health, racial reconciliation, we're not doing our job.
Culinary justice. You want culinary justice. What does that mean?
Well, culinary justice is what happens when people who have been historically oppressed are able to reap the full benefit of their cultural production through food. And it means giving people of color, poor folks. I mean, we're seeing an up. I want to make sure everybody knows that we're already seeing an uplift in terms of poor white Appalachian foodways. And yet, the same issues are there that they are in the African American community in the South. Mm-hmm. Not being able to get, you know, brick and mortar businesses, not being able to take advantage of certain spaces, having that food be represented outside the community in different ways than it is within the community, the lack of support for the knowledge bearers of those food traditions. So for me, culinary justice has a lot to do with quote-unquote race, but not everything to do with quote-unquote race. It affects anybody and everybody whose food tradition is, unfortunately, not a means of uplift.
When you were researching Cooking Gene, what was the most surprising thing that you learned about food, something that you didn't already know, and what did you learn that was surprising about your family?
Oh, the last one's easy. I mean, when you find out that you're related to Oliver Cromwell and Sarah Palin in the same day, it's kind of crazy.
Wow.
Pick one.
Yeah.
You can throw Dick Cheney and Samuel L. Jackson in there, so it's all good.
My goodness. Okay.
So that's something. But other than that, paprika on the potato salad. I think food-wise, I think people don't understand how many ways food affects, you know, decisions. For example, let's do a quick run through history of slavery and food. Sugarcane is really the catalyst crop of slavery. So in other words, put it like this. Somebody living 10,000 years ago in New Guinea who every human being has a sweet tooth because that's a natural thing. You know, that's part of our makeup, evolutionary makeup, to look for sweet things, for energy. Mm-hmm. So that person was thirsty. They cracked open a reed. They tasted really sweet. They began to domesticate it. The people in New Guinea say that the sugarcane is part of the root of humankind. So there's this thing where the food becomes part of the family tree. So if you're Native American, it's corn. If you're from Eastern Nigeria, where the ancestors of 25% of all African Americans came from, mm-hmm. it's the yam. But just that idea that one day someone had a sweet tooth and that plant crossed the globe and eventually led to, let's grow a lot of that.
Yeah.
Native Americans won't be our enslaved people. Let's go get Africans. And that's when the story begins.
So, Michael, this is amazing to me. So as a person who doesn't view food, and I see this as a bit of a failing of mine, right? As a person who doesn't view food through kind of a historical lens, as symbolic of things, who didn't grow up seeing the narrative of food as clearly as you do, explain to me and others like me what we've been missing all this time.
You know, something, it's these what I call food prints. You know, it's more than just, I think well, the first problem we have is that in our culture today, we rarely get beyond three generations of cultural and familial memory. In the past, even without, you know, literacy, without computers, without digitizing things, people's memory was a lot longer. And so those narratives really sustain people through a lot of tragedies and through a lot of failures. Although listening to the broadcast earlier today, none so glorious as having the ex-girlfriend crawl through the door.
Yeah,
that was hilarious.
Yeah, it was.
I had to remark on that. But y'all should have been there. It was cute. But it really goes down to that. I mean, I'm Jewish also, and people find that to be exotic, and I personally don't. And, you know, every year, Passover, you know, eating those symbolic foods, but also just the meal itself, people bringing things that have been a part of their family's existence for several hundred years and being able to tell stories around them. Well, as African-American, I do the exact same thing, mm-hmm. You know, that Sunday dinner context, with that reunion context. I mean, these foods have memory attached to them. Why do we eat that?
Right.
Because so-and-so in the country, and we did this, and we did that. Having that sort of contextual background that you're told by your elders, that you can pass on to your children, makes all the difference in the world. It is part of the flavor of the food.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Michael Twitty. He is a culinary historian. He will be speaking at the Atlanta History Center on September, when is that? That's Thursday, right?
Yep.
That's coming up on Thursday, 21st of September. And his new book is The Cooking Gene. What do you want people to ultimately take away from reading this book?
Well, I want people to understand it's really hard. that word American is a loaded term for us. And it's not easy to connect to. It's also not easy to connect to the word African. You're kind of caught suspended, you know, suspended animation, you know, like a piece of watermelon and Jell-O salad. And, you know, where do you go? Where do you go? So I went to Senegal in June after doing my DNA. I did multiple DNA tests on multiple relatives. And I was able to find roots in eight African, West African nations. And it was amazing.
Yeah.
I want people to understand how difficult that is, but how worthwhile it is. And for African Americans, this book tends to be a blueprint, a guide for finding their own culinary story and their own genetic story. Mm. For living history people, it's like, okay, when you do interpretation of slavery, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. And for food historians, people who are interested in Southern food, it's, this is the story from our perspective.
Yeah.
Lend me your ears.
Michael, it's a fascinating read. I'm working through it now. Congratulations. It's a triumph.
Thank you
it's an
so
achievement.
Much.
Yeah, that's culinary historian Michael Twitty. He is author of The Cooking Gene, and he speaks Thursday night at 8 o'clock at the Atlanta History Center. Michael, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tony.